You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Sue Carlson. Sue, thanks so much for being with me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening in the studio at that moment?
Well, right now, over this summer, I've been working on handmade paper. Squares. They're 9 inches by 9 inches. I've made 25 of them, but I might make 36 or 49 or 64. I'm not sure yet, but they need to always be able to hang as a square. And I've really kind of, these particular pieces, I've created limits so that the expression of the paint can come through so that there's not a lot of distraction. I've picked three pigments, viridian, helioturquoise, and titanium white, and those are the only pigments I'm using on these, and they're all with the same brush, and so the question is, how do these really communicate? You can't just say, oh, that's a green and blue painting, because they're all green and blue, and yet they're all very, very different. So that's kind of what I'm working on right now. They will hopefully probably be shown at Svenska Kyrkan, which is the Swedish church in New York City. And they have a little gallery there. And I had a show there in 2010. And for me, it's a very exciting context because I'm of Swedish descent. And the last time I put my paintings up there, people said, oh, that looks just like the Swedish landscape. But I've never been to Sweden. So it's very exciting to see. I'm from Minnesota, which there's a connection. So it's kind of a nice cultural context for me to show there. It's wonderful. So
that is interesting. And where is that exactly?
Oh, Svenska Kyrkan. It's on 48th Street between 5th and Madison. It's a beautiful, tiny little building nestled between big skyscrapers. And they do have a little coffee shop that's open every day where they serve Swedish pastries and coffee, and you can sit and you can read newspapers in Swedish, and the people don't really know about it, but it's a really sweet place to go. And I started going because of my family history background. I didn't know much about it, so I wanted to learn the language, so I started going there and meeting people there, and it's just a beautiful community, the beautiful little community of people.
I love that. It sounds like one of those New York secrets. I'll have to go there sometime.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit also about music. You're also a practicing musician now, aren't you?
Well, yes. I would call myself more a music teacher than a practicing musician, although I play for myself. And I don't do this, but I have for many years had the desire to begin every day playing Bach on the piano. I just think that would be like a gorgeous way to begin every day. Now, I haven't been able to do that exactly, but I think someday that will be what I do when I have the ability to do something like that. So I play for myself, and I taught piano for 25 years. I supported myself as a piano teacher. And
but you also performed as a pianist, didn't you?
Yes, I did some performing, but really more teaching. And the performing aspect of it wasn't as important to me. I really made a switch when I was about 23 from playing music. I played clarinet, chamber music, and piano. And I made a shift into painting. And it was very conscious to me, very clear to me that my artistic practice had shifted, and the same things I was doing with the clarinet and the piano, I was now doing with paint.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I want to talk about the relationship of music to your work. When that shift was occurring, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's just what I'd like to talk about. What was the conscious notion? It seems to me that music comes from such a different place that the kind of rigor involved in music isn't quite the same as visual art. So tell me how you approached it, because it sounds like you had a method of approaching it through the lens of music.
Yeah, I do. And even how I described what I've been doing this summer is kind of a method, isn't it? Now that you're saying this, I'm thinking back. Well, I began getting trained as a classical musician in high school, even earlier, but especially high school, I was really focusing on it. And then college, I went to Case Western Reserve University and the Cleveland Institute of Music, which was a joint program, and a really tremendous music education, very rigorous, and including also music history. And my understanding of European history comes more from music history than anywhere else. And so I was playing chamber music and playing piano and clarinet. But I also wanted to be like making things. I didn't just want to play the same pieces over and over again. I wanted to be making something, but I didn't really want to be a composer. I became very interested in the music of Edgar Varèse, who was making music in the 30s, 40s, 50s out of what he called sound masses. And if you look, the music was written in, like, he was trying to use traditional notation, like staffs and notes, and the contemporary composers who were trying to make other kinds of sounds, you look at the page of music and it looks completely weird. It's got all these squiggle lines because, you know, it's very hard to use that notation to do these crazy sounds. So in my senior year in music school, my project was to create a new notation for Edgar Varèse's sound masses. So I took colors and shapes and I decided that they stood for sounds, and I just, you know, made this like crazy piece of visual art that was supposed to be, you know, rigorously attached to Varèse. What Varèse was trying to do, he was always so frustrated because of the sounds that he wanted. He said, they don't come from violins, they don't come from cellos, that's from the last century, I need other sounds. And so I said, well, we need other notations. And having done that, you know, and it was, I also had the idea that putting paint on a brush and pulling it across a surface has a nuance. It has a physical hand nuance, the way a pianist touches the key. The way they touch the key has a nuance, and that's where all the expression is. And, you know, you listen to two different pianists, and they touch the piano differently. And so the same thing is true of painting. I mean, it's identical to me that every artist or painter has a hand like a voice. It's like a voice. And I think it would be familiar. You would be able to recognize that just the way you can recognize someone's voice, you know, throughout their work, no matter what they were painting. And so that just that way, when I drag my hand across the page, the brush across the page, the nuance of the hand, that's where the communication is for me. And
of
so
course,
that
just like a pianist, that's where the voice would be of a pianist.
Yes, exactly. And so that's a connection that I made. And what I'm saying, when I was 23, 24 and made this shift, I felt it was an actual physical shift of what I was touching the piano or blowing through the clarinet. I am now dragging a brush across a surface, and that's like the same thing.
That's very interesting. So that's really the language of music you began getting involved in or developing one. I mean, literally, notation.
Mm-hmm.
What was next visually for you with that kind of connection?
Well, I had always wanted to be a visual artist, but for some reason, when I was in college, I felt like I couldn't be because I'd never been trained in it. Now, in the music world, if you don't get started training young, they tell you you pretty much hang it up. You know, you can't start being a pianist at age 16 unless you're very unusual. So I had this feeling about it that, oh, well, I would have loved to have been a painter, but it's too late. But I just decided, I was 22, had graduated music school. I was in Minneapolis, and I decided to enroll in the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, MCAD. And I did that, and I went, and I had a blast. I had so much fun. And it was a lot of conceptual art. This was 1978, 79. And it felt easy to me. It felt fun and easy because I thought of myself as a musician, so I couldn't fail. You know, I'm not an artist, so if I screw this up, of course, I'm not an artist. You know, and
right.
it was wonderful, you know. And I really loved it, and I really wanted to do it. And there was a teacher there named Ken Feingold, who is a new media artist, and he's only 4 years older than me, but the teachers there were, you know, young and involved and wonderful. And he told me, look, if you really want to do this, you should go to CalArts, because he said that's the best art school in the country right now. So I applied to CalArts with the conceptual portfolio that I had just created at MCAT, and I got in on a conceptual portfolio. And they also asked me to write an essay, which I did, and then it was Michael Asher who read my application and asked me to write an even longer essay, which I did, you know, about the theory of conceptual art, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I showed up there and I said, I want to be a painter. And that was really, really fun because, again, I was in the context of conceptual art, but I wasn't a conceptual artist, so I can't fail.
Let's talk about that because that's such an interesting scene. Michael Asher, of course, is legendary, and the crits and classes
yes.
he developed there.
Yes.
So how were you fitting in as a painter? Because wasn't Michael Asher essentially, he was talking with everybody, or was it mostly conceptual work that he was involved with?
I just want to say it was such a wonderful place for me to be. And I feel so fortunate to have had the art education that I had. And yes, I was just about the only painter. And so the critiques were intense, and I was very, like, right up there. With my kind of aesthetic ideas that came from music. And I just, you know, how can you say painting is dead? That's like saying nobody can dance anymore because somebody already danced, you know? And to me, it just was very, very clear. And it was actually a lot of fun, the dialogues and the back and forth. So Michael Asher, there was a lot of, you know, he really challenged me. And at one point, I remember I kind of stopped going to his seminar, and then I came back, and I was feeling, like, very rebellious. You know, he didn't want you to smoke cigarettes in his class, and I was smoking at the time. I had a cigarette in my hand, and he said, get back in class. And I said, I have a cigarette. He said, I don't care. Get back in here, you know. And so he had me get back in there. And Bill Wirtz was his TA. You know, Bill goes by B. Wirtz, you know, wonderful artist. It was just a wonderful context, and I remember saying, he was talking about the conceptual work of Dan Slavin, and I raised my head. I think Dan Slavin's a painter. And he was like, whoa, that's a pretty good idea. so it was really fun. And the other idea I had that I remember Michael liked was that, and this is pretty arrogant, but I was 24. You know, I said, I don't believe in the term postmodern. I don't think, you know, anything is postmodern. When we went from the Baroque to the classical in music, from like Bach to Haydn, there was a cultural shift. There was a political shift. There was a revolution, French Revolution, American Revolution. There was an economic shift. None of that has happened here. We haven't had a cultural revolution like that. And
right.
we You know, and Michael said, yeah, that's really true. You know, so it was a really cool dialogue. And my theory was that we're still, like, in modernism, you're in, like, the cult of the artist as almost, like, shaman or somebody who has something to say. And that still exists in conceptual art. You're looking at the conceptual artist as somebody who has something individual to say. And that is actually modernism. So I don't know. At one point the teachers started telling me, you know, quit worrying about what art is and just make it, you know, and people, and that was like, my other teachers were, John Baldessari was my mentor, and, Jeremy Gilbert Rolfe was another very important teacher for me. And they were, John and Doug Hubler, who was also wonderful. the two of them, you know, yeah, I know, wow is right. And those are two of the most important seminal conceptual artists, John Baldessari and Doug Hubler, and they both loved painting. They love painting. So the idea that conceptual artists think painting is dead, it was so clear to me that that's not true. And
I know, why does that persist? Because I still hear that from different artists, that no one's interested in painting anymore, it's all conceptual. That's such a strange misconception, isn't it?
It really is, and I don't see. I was, you know, again, you're talking about me being very arrogant at that time. I would just say, you should just say you don't know how to make a painting. You shouldn't say that everybody can't make a painting. You know, this you haven't figured. So, I mean, that just seemed very clear to me. And, you know, John couldn't have been a more wonderful teacher for me. Just, you know, and knowing how to tutor a young painter who had never made a painting before. And he said, the way you make paintings is you rely on a certain level of spontaneity. You don't like work the thing. When you do it, you rely on like something happened there, even on the first level, even though I might rework it. So he said that's how the abstract expressionists did it. And they made lots of bad paintings, and maybe they would pick 10 in a year that they would say were okay. And he said to me, you have to make 100 bad paintings now before you get to make one good one, so just get started and don't worry about it. And, you know, I can't imagine a better painting teacher than that.
That's wonderful. It's also such a different break, again, from music, isn't it?
It was a fresh break from music, a fresh break because, you know, in music there's a lot of emphasis on technique and there's a lot of emphasis on you having a wonderful, important, famous teacher and you emulating your teacher. And in art, you're basically supposed to, like, murder your teacher, you know? You're supposed to do something, do something completely different. And that, like, nobody talked like that in conservatory. So that was really exciting. And I had never painted, so I didn't have any painting technique. So this was interesting. I went to Jeremy Gilbert Rolfe, who was a wonderful painter, and I said to him, I want you to teach me the technique of painting. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, the brushes and like when you use oil and when you use watercolor and what kind of brush you use and how big. And he picked up that book of Ralph Meyer, The Techniques of Painting, and he handed it to me. It's like this huge thick book, and he said, here, read this. And I looked at it, and I said, this is boring to read. And he looked at me, and he said, well, it's boring to teach. And so he was not going to teach me technique. He was not going to teach me technique. So I went to John Baldessari, and I said, do you think I should learn how to draw the figure? And he said, no, wait, don't learn any technique just for the sake of technique. Wait until your art needs something, and then when it needs that thing, you will go and learn how to do it. And that's the way you must approach technique. And not only did I adopt that for my own practice, but in teaching my piano students, I remembered what John said, because I would never have a student do scales and arpeggios. I would wait until I could give them a beautiful piece of music that had a scale or an arpeggio in it, and then they would really want to be able to do it because the music was so beautiful. And then I could say, oh, well, let's learn how to do these things. And that came directly from what John had said to me about technique.
Wow, amazing group of people you were surrounded with there. And so then moving forward to after that, you're out in the world and getting shows and feeling great about painting. How did the next steps happen in terms of getting an exhibit with your new work?
Well, I came to New York. I think maybe about half of our class of CalArts came to New York, and maybe half stayed in L.A. But it was a big group of people who came, and I sublet studio on the Bowery, and Jeremy was very generous of introducing me to some of his artist friends, and one of those people who was very important to me as a painter was Michael Goldberg, tremendous, you know, abstract expressionist painter. And coming from CalArts, Now here I would go to his studio and I would kind of watch what was going on, and he was like throwing this paint around in such an intelligent manner, such a thoughtful manner. I really learned a lot from that. I also had an internship in Lucio Pozzi's studio, and that was wonderful too. So here's another painter. And in about 1986, I think, I was working in Elizabeth Murray's studio. My friend Mary Carlson, who is a sculptor, was on a team. Well, she headed a team that was building those shaped stretchers that Elizabeth Murray was using in the mid-80s, where they, you know, bend it off the wall. And so Mary was head of this little team, and Mary actually hired me to work there. And Elizabeth would give Mary a drawing, a 2D drawing, and Mary would interpret that and create a 3D object that then Elizabeth could paint on. And so I was one of the team. I was a soldier. I was not a thinker. I was a soldier, and I was told what to do. And we took 1x2s, and we created these kind of shapes, and then we would soak thin plywood, Luon, in water, and bend it onto the 1x2s and keep gluing layers and layers and clamping it down and keep creating layers and then sanding it down until we created something that was curved. And then
that's like making a boat.
It was like, yeah, I think so. I think so. And then we'd put canvas on it, and then she'd paint on it. And that time was exciting for me because one of the stretchers I worked on is now in the Museum of Modern Art. So I love to go there and see it and go, I made that corner right there, you know, the little corner of the thing. So I learned how to make these shaped stretchers. And so in the studio, I started making some kinds of shaped stretchers, but the surface was always flat. But I would create shapes, like curved shapes. And what I was started making was architecture from like Piero della Francesca, like, you know, buildings that came out of Piero's paintings, or a ziggurat from Ur, you know, something ancient, something old. And I would make these buildings. And then I would paint make it look like the building by painting the facade on top of it. And I showed it at White Columns to Tom Solomon, and he was going to show it, but then he left. And that's when a very young Bill Arning took over White Columns, and he was the one who showed that work. He gave me a show at White Columns. That was my first solo show, and the White Room, and that was just wonderful.
Which is a nice way to just enter into the art world. For those people who don't know it, that's, of course, an important nonprofit in New York City.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And it was really wonderful work. And, of course, Bill was the studio visit king. I mean, he would go to thousands of studios, and he's just such an energetic and wonderful person to, you know, be around and work with. And so I put those pieces up there. And I didn't really know why I was making these like little buildings, ancient buildings, because I didn't really think I was going to do that the rest of my life, but I wanted to do that. And later on, I read that Mark Rothko went to Greece and saw the temples, and the young guide was asking, like, who are these Americans looking at these Greek temples? Actually, I think he was in Italy looking at Greek temples. And the guide said, who are these Americans? Who are they? And the translator said, well, they're painters, they're artists. And the guide then said, well, are they coming to paint the temples? And Rothko said, tell them that I've been painting Greek temples my whole life and not knowing it. And when I read, yeah, is that great?
I love them. Yeah,
and
wonderful.
So when I read that, I thought, wow, that's kind of like, that has something to do with why I wanted to make those buildings. Because I was trying to capture something that was like historic and ancient and moving. And somehow, like, how do you make a painting with that kind of feel in it? And I didn't really know how, so I just tried to make the shapes and see if I could get somewhere with it.
So that's interesting. And does that seems like it almost connects to the piece you were talking about at the beginning, the shapes you're using and how you're building that the current work?
Yes, I think it does. Yeah, I think it does. I think it all very much connects. And the work I made right after White Columns was it was rectangle then. It was little rectangles, not big pieces. I don't know, 12 by 16 maybe or smaller. But they had like remnants of like facades on them, but a lot more brush stroke. And I showed those at Berlin Hall Gallery. And so that was kind of the next step in. And
and then you were meeting a lot of people. That was quite a time. We're talking about the 80s now.
Yeah, the 80s and the 90s. And, yeah, it was a very interesting time. I never really felt, I mean, I felt sort of odd in the 80s and the late 80s because there were so many, like, former CalArts students having gigantic success, like David Sally, or artists having huge success. And I had always approached it thinking like Barnett Newman, like I'd get my first show when I was 55, you know, and that this was, you know, I didn't ever think I was going to make money on it, and I thought of it as more of a spiritual practice. And so all of that activity going around me just sort of like confused me. I mean, it was okay. I did what I had to do, but it was a funny little blip in the art world. You know, at that moment that was going on. But, you know, a lot of artists, some artists got caught up in that and really wanted high success at a very early age. But many, many people just kept making their work, you know. And,
well, so you were facing that head on. I mean, like you're saying, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to hear what Baldessari said, but, you know, your classmates were creating and entering into that kind of new sphere of money and art success, quote unquote.
Yes, well, and like one of my classmates was Ashley Bickerton, who became wonderful, you know, his wonderful work and became very successful. And I don't know, I can't remember everybody that was there right now, but yes, there was like CalArts was like the CalArts Mafia, right? That's what they would talk about. And I loved the place, but I felt, you know, that wasn't what I was clamoring for. You know, I really wanted to be a painter. I really wanted to develop a language. And that to me was the most important thing. It wasn't, I was a kind of a shyer person, a more quiet person. I didn't kind of even know how to begin going in there. Now, I've since become friends with Mary Heilman, who talks about, you know, duking it out in the boys' club. And God bless her for doing that, because she cleared some space for people like me. You know, I'm about, I guess, about 15 years younger than she is. And so that's a generation in the art world. And, yeah, there were that generation of women artists, just about one generation ahead of me, were really fighting it out, and they were really clearing space so that people like me didn't have to think about that as much.
But it seems to me your approach is also a little bit different. If I mean, saying before, you know, as, you know, comparing the kind of making art and thinking about success and money as opposed to looking at it as a spiritual practice, as you said, that's quite a distinction to make, because then it's not as though, you know, you're not interested in the market or this particular stance against the market, but it has nothing to do with the market, and the work isn't focused in that area. And perhaps, you know, Mary Heilman was also, that was a different kind of a battle because her work, the content was so different, do you think? Do you know what I'm saying, or no?
It could be. I can't really so much speak for her, but I can say
I mean, I'm saying approaching it as a spiritual practice, sorry to interrupt, but approaching it as a spiritual practice seems like a powerful way to navigate the world, almost like when you said, now I'm a painter, no matter what you guys are doing, you were doing your painting. If you approach it as a spiritual practice, to some degree, nothing can stop that. Nothing can compete with that.
Yeah, that's very true. And I would believe that Mary also sees her painting as a practice. And yes, if you've got that, you're not going to quit. And And it's like practicing the piano. It's like, you know, I want to play Bach. I want to play it because it's amazing, you know. And so I want to do it. And you know, I want to drag paint across the surface because there's an ancient history of doing that, and it connects me with history. And I want to keep doing that. I also don't want to give the wrong impression. I deeply believe in the dialogue. In the dialogue of being out and showing. And I think that's just very important. You can't just sit in your own room and make paintings, because you need people responding and you need to put it out there. So I want to also say that I have always thought that's a very important part of it as well.
Yeah, that's a good point to mention, because the idea of talking about art as spiritual practice to some degree sounds as though it doesn't need to be exhibited. It's something alone. But of course, right, it has to be exhibited, and that's powerful to talk about. So maybe we should just close on talking a little bit about that, because that's so important, and it's often tied to the market or not. The importance of exhibition. You're talking about it. Whether you're selling or not selling, right? This isn't a market issue. You're talking about the importance of exhibition because of dialogue. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then what should that dialogue be like? What is that dialogue that we're after, or that you mean by that?
Well, you know, even though I talk about this practice, I'm certainly not an outsider artist. Having gone to CalArts, working in Elizabeth Murray Studio and all that, I can't claim to have, you know, denounced all of that. Not at all. I was in the center of it. The dialogue, that's a tough one to describe. It's like your lifeblood as an artist. I would say to young artists, you have to be talking to other artists. You know, you can't just sit alone and not, because you get an inspiration and ideas from other artists, and then you take an idea and you make it yours, and it comes through your language, and then somebody else sees it in your language and puts it in their language, and then it speaks back to you, and it's a language. You can't, you know, language is communication. And so there has to be communication. My people that I talk to, some are painters, you know, some are sculptors, some are musicians. Some are theologians and ministers. But they're all people who are trying to make something that's never been done before. And that was one thing Baldessari said: is a good reason to make art is because there's what you need to see isn't out there, and so you need to make the thing that you need to see. And I think that in any discipline, all these disciplines that I mentioned, that's what people are doing. That's sort of the connection. Like, why don't I have a connection to somebody who makes paint by number and puts it up in a shopping center? Because in the suburban Minneapolis context of a lot of people knowing nothing about, like, the, quote, art world, some folks there and some adults would say, oh, your daughter's an artist. Well, you know, my daughter made some paint by numbers and put them up in the mall. And, like, I had to really think, like, what's the difference? What is the difference? Well, the difference is that thing that I'm talking about, that you're really trying to do something that hasn't been done, or it's original to you. You know, it's sui generis. I like that term. You're giving birth to it. So that, to me, people who are striving for that are the people I can connect to. And of course, there's many artists who do that. And you know, you just have to look all over. I did a collaboration in 2007 with some artists I met online, and they were creating a magazine called Art Scene, which is a magazine of artists only wrote for the magazine, only practicing artists. And they wrote criticism, and they wrote reviews. It was Gordana Bezanov, who was originally from Serbia but was in Florence at the time, and Andrew Smaldone, who's an American artist who lives in Florence. And they just had this international gang that we had all connected on the Internet. I've never met these people physically, but we were so close. And I ended up writing a review of a Nordic landscape painting show that I saw in Minnesota, and I wrote about it as a painter and a Scandinavian person, you know, not as an art critic. And that, again, was, like, so refreshing. And then Gordana curated a show in Sardinia. So my work was in Sardinia, and Andrew curated a show in Bologna. So I was exhibiting in Italy. And just that, you know, but they had that connection of authenticity, of trying to do something that nobody had done, trying to create a language and a dialogue. And I just think artists have to really look for that. I think that's why we're here. You have to seek it out.
Sue, thanks so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.